Ho ho! Happy holidays, everyone! It's me, Santa Nate! And this holiday season, we've got a special treat for you! Edenverse Volume 1 is on sale on Amazon.com for 99 cents! Buy 5 copies for the price of 1! Ho 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 ho!
Give them to someone you hate.
Words About Books is a poorly spoken podcast. Each month, we read a different book, and each week we discuss either that book or something else going on in literature. I'm Nate, and as always, I'm joined by my good friend, Ben. How's it going?
His good friend who he won't tell what we're talking about or why we're here. I have no idea what this episode is. I guess I'm going to find out as you find out, dear listener.
Well, the listener will probably know ahead of time. I assume that this will be titled in a way that...
Oh, good. So they already know more than I do. Enjoy your privilege, listener.
Yeah, you jerk. So Ben has this thought that we're going to be talking about like one of my old works. Is that right, Ben? That's what you keep saying.
That was my guess, based on the fact that I don't know what other subjects you possibly could be interested in that you would think would be a surprise.
So Ben thinks that he can read me. Unbeknownst to him, I'm a world champion poker player. So he was thinking that guess was entirely correct and has blinded him to the truth. So Ben, what day does this episode go out? It goes out December 27th.
Happy birthday, Mom.
Okay, that wasn't what I was going for.
Okay, next.
So originally, I wanted to record this like a week before. So that would be December 20th.
Okay.
So what was important about December 20th? So about a year ago, there was a ban placed upon me on December 20th. You got it?
Oh, God. So, okay, yeah, there was a ban placed on you, and it was also a ban that was placed on you in one of our lowest viewed episodes. So no one knows what the hell you're talking about. This is perfect. Yeah, The Fold Part 3 is what you need to pay attention to get the most out of this one, apparently. Okay, go on. Yeah, I'm not sure what... I don't know where you're going with this, man, but you're going to have to make it relatable.
Okay, well, let's relay it to a couple things about the podcast. So we read 14 a year or two ago, right, by Peter Kleins, probably even further. And you know what the worst part about that book was? All the shit inspired by H.P. Lovecraft. It all connects, Ben.
Is this your just like your revenge? Is that what the title of the episode is going to be?
No, actually, Ben.
Revenge of the Nate?
I read Paradox Bound, and I'm going to talk about it with you.
Oh my God. The sequel literally no one wanted. And on every level.
This is how we're going off the air this year.
We better reintroduce Peter Kleins, because like I said, I guess this is more an item from our look back episode, but there's kind of two distinct ages of the podcast in my mind, and that is
pre-Dune and post-Dune?
Yeah, before Dune and after Dune. Where before Dune, we had just started out, it was like friends and family, and then after Dune, it was like tons of listens, well, relatively for us, and so yeah, almost, this is in the before Dune times, so I'm gonna guess most of you don't know who Peter Kleins is. Most of you don't know what the hell we're talking about, or the relevance of Paradox Bound, or this strange niche author that we have made our arch nemesis. Oh, God.
So Peter Kleins is a problematic author. we read one of his books earlier this year.
I mean, J.K. Rowling's a problematic author. Peter Kleins is just kind of not great.
He's problematic for me, Ben. He shattered my dreams, Ben. He wrote a really good book called 14 that we both liked, except for the H.P. Lovecraft stuff. And then he wrote a much, much worse book called The Fold that we talked about here on this podcast. And then we went in great detail talking about Peter Kleins and some of his other work. And then I was banned from talking about him for an entire year. And here we are.
I remember banning you from talking about him.
The good old days before COVID.
Yeah. Oh, God. It feels like 4 years ago.
So I read Paradox Bound and I took copious notes for you and also for the listener.
I just want to add one thing before we jump into it. So, did you mention the threshold?
Oh, no. Please tell us about the threshold.
Okay, so Peter Kleins initially wrote 14, which we both liked. We thought it was like a little charming character drama with a supernatural twist. And then 14, or not 14, I'm sorry. The Fold was a loose continuation of that story. It takes place in the same universe, which is called the Threshold Universe. So called because the one common theme all of these stories share is interdimensional travel.
And a Cthulhu monster.
Yes, and there's Lovecraftian demons that are slowly eating all the parallel universes. And they keep trying to get into ours. Yeah, I guess this is the ultimate appeal for you to go re-listen to our Fold episodes. I want to say I don't want to rehash it, but why do I feel like we're about to? I'm guessing, so we liked 14, we did not like The Fold. For anyone wondering where the phrase deep in the crease comes from, that was us making fun of The Fold. As you say, here's Nate to just kick Peter Kleins one more time. unless you liked it.
Well,
did you like it?
Let me be fair to him. I tried my best to not like it, actually.
Really?
And I would say it's his second best book that I've read out of the four that I read.
Wow. Okay. I'm actually interested to hear about this.
Yeah, because there are some problems I had with it that actually at least were somewhat explained in the book, and it was just a fun little light adventure novel instead of trying to be some weird hard science fiction thing.
So what, remind me, what is the plot of Paradox Bound?
Oh, I'm willing to go all the way in depth with that plot. Is this the one
on the moon?
No, God, okay. No, that's Dead Moon.
Okay, because I was surprised.
Yeah, I have no desire to read any more Peter Kleins books, Ben. This is it for me.
Okay.
This is the closing of our first year on the podcast. It's a fitting closing.
It is. It really is. I mean, this one probably wasn't as important to the listeners as it was. This one nearly broke me. I didn't know how bad the year was going to get, but at the time, this seemed pretty bad. But, I know nothing about Paradox Bound, then. I thought this was Dead Moon.
No, Paradox Bound is the story of Eli Teague.
Teague.
Yes.
Okay.
It starts off, he's an 8-year-old boy in Sanders, Maine, as all good stories start.
Oh, no, I know what this one is. I remember this now.
This is the time travel one.
Yeah, this is the time travel one.
Yeah. Okay. So there's a bunch of cultural references in this first chapter, especially. And finally, Eli runs into a teenage man wearing Revolutionary War clothing named Harry, who's trying to fix his car really quickly. He's out of fuel or something. Eli's really not paying attention, but apparently the car runs on water, and Harry dumps some fuel in there. Her partner comes back, and they drive off, and they're
quickly...
You
just said it was a man.
Fuck! Okay, spoilers. It turns out it's a lady later on. Yeah, so they're chased quickly by a guy with his eyes closed, ? Who's shooting a gun at them. And the man who turns out to
accurate?
Be a woman. No, he's not.
Probably because he has his eyes closed. Was he trying to show off?
So this is so you, the audience, know that time travel is involved because Harry yells back, "See you in a few years, Eli." Some big brain shit right there.
So Eli was the partner that...
Oh my god, you're figuring it out too quickly, Ben.
Okay.
This is unraveling this mystery.
Yeah, I don't think we're going to need Poirot for this one.
I believe his name is pronounced Poirot. Thank you very much. So then we go to Eli at the age of 13. And I think this... I talked about this in our episode of Peter Klein's that only like 10 people listen to. He uses the phrase swelling to talk about female anatomy. And he catches a glimpse of a nipple. And that's how he realizes, oh, this is actually a lady.
What are we talking about? How did we get here?
Eli had... There's a time skip, and now Eli's 13. Keep up, Ben. Come on.
Okay. And he's
runs
looking
into
Harry at a nipple?
Again. He runs into Harry again.
And she's not wearing a shirt?
She's wearing a shirt, but not a bra.
Oh. Okay. That's such a weird way to do this. So, like, he could see her full boob, but he didn't know it was, like, a female anatomy until he saw the nipple?
I think that he noticed it up close, even before he started seeing her nipple.
How close is he to her nipple?
Pretty close.
What's going on?
Harry's fixing her car again.
Okay.
Also, Harry doesn't seem to recognize him because of time travel.
She hasn't met him yet.
Right.
Okay.
And then we skip ahead to when he's 29.
Okay. I mean, I've also seen this episode of Doctor Who.
Yeah, it's with Amy Pond. Yeah. So apparently Eli spent his entire life in Sanders, even though he hates it. He's got like 3 friends, a job working a few towns over on a bank's computer system.
Please tell me Sanders is in Kentucky, but I'm going to guess California because
Maine.
It's Peter Klein's. Damn it.
It's Maine. Sanders, Maine. So Eli becomes a bit of a car expert, and oh boy, does Peter Klein's let you know that constantly. I think Peter Klein's maybe wanted an outlet for his weird car obsession, so...
As long as he's not talking about C++ and hackers anymore, I'll be happy.
No, he doesn't really do that. Which is good news for you.
So there's no hot hacker chick in this one.
No. And in fact, I'm going to spoil it right now. The 2 leads don't even hook up.
So this is just Doctor Who.
It's Doctor Who and National Treasure, as we're going to find out.
You took the most British thing there is and then the most American
thing. Oh my God, Ben. I want you to think about the phrase "the most American thing" as we continue on this trek. It gets so fucking American, it actually hurt to read at times.
Like pounding cheeseburgers and shooting.
Even worse. So anyway, let's get to when Eli he runs into Harry again at night, and I guess he just wants to like hang out with her or something because he's like, "Hey, I didn't show you around. My place is just up the block or whatever." And
does he recognize her as the same woman?
Yes. And she recognizes him, also thinks he's kind of a pervert. So there's some self-awareness here on the part of the author. I'm really impressed. She also calls him very nice, clever, and handsome, but you know, baby steps.
Does he have ants in his brain?
No.
Well,
and
then
he
he's not that clever, is he?
Every at least 1 in 4 pages.
Eli isn't some sort of magic Superman. He's more of an everyman like Nate from 14.
Okay.
Eli's like, all right, cool. Can I go with you? And she's like, no. No, you can't. I need to be in Boston in 2 days. I don't know why she tells him that. Probably so he could follow her eventually, right? So the plot can get going.
He's going to follow her to Boston?
Well, what happens next is he's at work the next day, and his boss shows up, and I'm not going to mention his boss because you find out later he's a time traveler, but then he just, like, he gets killed, and, like, he's irrelevant to the plot. But after his boss leaves, the lights go out, and there's a man wearing a plastic mask, a business suit, and, like, a fedora or a bowler hat or something, and he's got no face. No face at all. None there. The guy introduces himself as 15, and he threatens Eli and beats his ass, so you know he's the bad guy.
More than 14.
Oh my god. Well, this
Detective
guy also...
Detective Ben's back on the case.
This guy also cracks the code, and he realizes that Harry the fugitive was going to Boston in 2 days, and he tells Eli, don't leave town. So, of course, Eli immediately leaves town.
Do you know how big Boston is?
Well, it was a specific marketplace she mentioned.
They're going to the Boston Market? Really?
Oh, man. I like Boston Market. It's gone now. Okay. So he meets a guy there, by complete chance, who happens to know that Harry's going to Pasadena, California. And you just missed her. And wait a minute. I'm sorry. Did you tell me that those guys... like told you not to leave town and then you left town? They tailed you. And they did. And they tailed him, and the guy he was just talking to gets shot in the head in the middle of a crowded Boston market.
Well, that took a turn Doctor Who doesn't usually go for. That's how you know this isn't Doctor Who. So are these guys the so this must be the National Treasure portion of it. So these guys are either the Sean Bean factor or that guy with the mustache who turned out to be a good guy in the end, but he's like in the FBI.
So these guys are the faceless men behind the power of the United States. A line so cheesy I had to read it twice.
Okay. I'm going to let you in on a little secret. No one's in charge of the United States. It's chaos.
Yeah.
Go on.
It's a nightmare. So he goes to Pasadena. Well, first he's thinking like, okay, maybe I shouldn't throw my life away for a girl I've only known for like 20 minutes over the course of like 29 years. But on the other hand, that guy just got shot in the fucking head and I'm probably next. So I kind of don't have a choice but to link up with her at this point. So he goes to Pasadena, California.
Do you know how big Pasadena is?
They have a landmark this time. The fork. It's a giant fork in the ground.
Okay.
Yeah, he runs into her, and she makes him dig something up at gunpoint, and I don't think it ever tells us what it is, but it's implied to be something that's irrelevant to the plot, pretty much. And
Is this a self-contained story, or is there a sequel?
This is a self-contained story.
Okay.
All right, you ready for the faceless men to show up again, Ben?
I guess. That seems like another, like, Kleinsism. Like, there's always a suit watching you or something.
Well, this time it's two of them. Harry shoots the faceless guy, but he just no-sells it like the Terminator. Like, he hits the ground, but then he just gets back up. And I'll explain that in a bit, but it's really dumb. All right. But that buys time for them to escape from the faceless men. And Harry mentions that nobody has ever escaped from two of them. But then they did, which I called bullshit on. But there's actually an explanation, Ben, other than plot armor and being the main character.
Okay. They didn't escape. He let them go.
No. No, it's not that. It's something you wouldn't have thought of. Because it doesn't make any sense.
So they're the chosen ones?
No, not quite. Not that dumb.
they like figured out the Matrix and freed their minds.
Nope.
They moved like he did.
Because it's not something you can get.
Okay.
All right. So after they make their escape, they're pulled over by some cops, and then they stupid their way out and throw caltrops on the road, and slide back in time, Ben.
Wait, are the cops in on this?
The cops are used by the faceless men. Yes. Local enforcement can be used by them.
Okay, it's not really the Matrix because they're not like physically taking them over, but
right, right.
Okay.
They're used by them. They're not being controlled.
Okay, I'm imagining agents, but go on.
That's fair. So, Eli is actually, he's not a complete idiot because he realizes like, "Oh, I figured there's probably time travel involved somehow." But he can't seem to wrap his head around the fact that the car runs on water. That's, like, something his big brain can't comprehend.
What?
Yes.
What year was he born?
He was born in probably the late 70s. He grew up in the 80s. Of course he did, right?
So what year did they time travel from? Like,
probably around present day. Well, present day is probably, like, 2015 or 2013 when the book came out.
Okay. I mean, we know how to extract hydrogen from water. It's just really expensive, and that's why we don't do it. But it's not hard to imagine they found a way to make it inexpensive. But I guess maybe Peter Kleins didn't know that.
Well, he said that she got this technology from the future.
Correct.
Yeah.
Perhaps she is from the future.
She's from the 1880s.
Oh. That explains the no bra thing. Well, no, wait. They were like strapped up as shit.
So now we're going to go back to what will become Zero. I didn't think this would actually go anywhere, but this is actually somewhat important for some reason. So Eli's childhood bully Zeke, he's a cop in their hometown, and the faceless men abduct him and operate on him to turn him into a faceless man.
Did they know he was the childhood bully?
They knew he was a police officer in that town.
Why did it need to be in that town? Why did they need another one?
See, these are the questions I was asking. I was like, why the fuck do they need this guy? That doesn't make sense. And Peter Kleins has a reason for that.
Okay.
I know. I was shocked too.
Okay, we'll see.
So the faceless men, though, I feel like they're supposed to come off as, like, menacing, but they come off as, like, angry children throwing a tantrum, because he beats the shit out of Zero, who was Zeke, right?
I'm gonna need you to maybe get off his back on that one, because we do have an Eden episode coming up.
Hey.
Where I have to explain...
Game recognizes game.
Yeah, I was gonna say, I have to explain why our... supposedly intimidating people just keep getting run over by cars.
Because it's funny.
It's fucking hilarious.
So it's told to everyone, basically. All the characters become aware in two different conversations that these faceless men can see with, quote, absolute certainty in a 300-foot radius. So that's described by two characters that it's, you know, a room you've been through many times, even with the lights out, for example.
You have never seen me in my living room with the lights out.
This is how you get a Lego injury to the foot.
I've walked into walls. I don't know what the fuck he's talking. Maybe he's got some weird spider sense about rooms he's been in, but
So you'd be a bad faceless man.
Yeah. To be fair, though, Nate, our listeners don't know this because it's a podcast, but my face is kind of like where the money comes from.
Oh,
you know. So
here's the exposition dump, Ben.
Okay.
It took me out of the story. Are you ready to get American as shit?
I was born American as shit.
All right. So the founding fathers wanted to make a nation. Apparently, they had only altruistic goals, but most of it...
Well, they probably should have done something about all the slavery.
Whoa, we'll get to that. But, quote, most of these people were only a few generations out of feudalism, end quote, which is objectively untrue, Peter. Feudalism died at least 200 plus years prior, almost 300 years, but it's okay. I'll give you a pass.
This is like when a metal band goes butt rock. Peter Kleins is selling out to Middle America.
So the founding fathers, they needed to convince the people to rise up and form a better nation. So Benjamin Franklin, he figured out a ritual to summon Ptah, the Egyptian god of creation, to forge the American dream.
Okay.
like he and the founding fathers did a fucking ritual to create nationalism.
Okay. And did that come in the form of like a petty bitch allegiance from France to spite England? Because that's kind of what carried us through.
That is kind of what carried us through, yes.
So it wasn't about taxation without representation or anything like that. They just wanted to form the world's most perfect union.
Yes. That lasted less than 100 years.
What?
We had a civil war.
Oh, yeah, I mean...
We had to fight to keep half the shit perfect country together. So Eli, he thinks, when he hears this, that it is the most preposterous horse shit he's ever heard in his life. But Harry's like, yeah, no, I heard it from my previous partner, and he heard it from his previous partner, and just up on the chain.
How many women did you fuck, lady?
Not enough. Her explanation is like, yeah, there's no way that could be true, because then, like, we'd have, like, obelisks in the federal capital or, like, pyramids on our currency.
Oh, my God. Is that... Oh, my God.
Yes! I groaned.
Oh, my God. Good job.
So I'd now like to read a direct quote.
Okay.
Quote, have you ever heard people talk of a town or part of a city that's, say, stuck in the 1950s? Or the 1920s, or the last century, sayings like that? Yeah, of course. Well, sometimes, more times than you'd think, they are. A road, or a neighborhood, or a whole town can get stuck in history, and history just passes them by. You see, Ben, the American dream allows people to live how they want, and for their hopes and beliefs to come true. So that's why... They can just stay in a town where it's 1950 for decades.
This doesn't explain slavery or the Civil War.
When did this book come out?
I believe it was
2015.
But let
ooh
me...
ooh should have waited a year.
2017.
Well then, okay.
What?
I don't know about this one, Peter. I don't know about these choices. I don't think I'd put it that way.
So, let's say a great number of people believe the same thing. That this town or this era is the pinnacle of how things should always be. The mindsets, the culture, the technology. They believe this is the moment which defines the very best of America. Or, in some rare cases, the worst of it. When enough of these people get together and their belief... focuses the dream and makes these things so. That point is pinned down and stuck while the rest of the history moves on past it, or piles up around it, really. So, like, what about the Civil War and slavery?
Yeah, that's, that, what the hell was he thinking?
These are called slick spots where you can slide across history. And then my next note was, oh, no. There are specific slick spots, Ben. Like a road in Dallas that only leads to November 1963 and a bus route in Montgomery that only goes to December of 1955.
Oh, in Montgomery, you say? 55, oh. You say?
Oh, no.
Oh, no. Oh, no. What are the reviews on this book like?
Probably overwhelmingly positive. You know this how is... reviews are.
Oh, my God. What?
Also, Ben, did you know that only American steel can go through the slick spots?
Oh, my God. What does that even mean?
You can't drive a shitty foreign car through, Ben.
They're all made of foreign steel. We haven't made steel. We haven't made steel in 50 years. Oh my God. Oh so, my God. What tone deafness. Just, oh my God.
You're going through the same things I went through.
Who could have read this and been like, we need to be, you know what? I guarantee somebody was like, we need to be proud of our heritage again. We need to focus on the things that unite us, not divide us. We need to embrace our American folk tradition. And then it's just like, you know, at least National Treasure was like, they were people with a stolen treasure, which is just like, yeah, I guess National Treasure made sense. I don't know. I don't want to get too political here, but I could think of some people who would probably, the natives, who would probably know.
I also thought of that. I was like, yeah. Oh, I guess the American dream, like, fucked them, basically. Repeatedly.
Yeah. I mean, oh boy. Oh boy, oh boy, oh boy, oh boy. That's,
this is the reaction I was hoping for, Ben.
How could you... Okay, see, now because we haven't... With every book we do, we usually talk about it beforehand, and now I'm just like, this might have to be a two-parter, because I'm like, I've got so many things I want to say. Like, normally I say them to you, and we refine them a bit and chop it up, but I'm like, what
well,
was
if it
he
needs
thinking?
To be a two-parter, we can release it one on the 25th and one on the 27th.
Merry Christmas.
Christmas episode.
Oh, God. What was he thinking? Did it even... Oh, it must not have. Or he just didn't want to deal with it.
No, the book does not address shit like that.
So do you think it occurred to him that this would be problematic?
I'm going to say no.
Or do you think it occurred to him, but he just thought, you know what?
People might not think about that.
Well, I just don't want to deal with that here. I just want to have like a little lighthearted, you know, American folklore story. But the... I guess I just want to get this point out there. This is something I normally would like jot down for like discussion in our notes as I'm absorbing this book, but the reason we don't have as many American mythos stories these days, or at least as many like uncomplicated American mythos stories, is because it's not real. Like, it was a fucking mess to begin with. There was genocide, there was slavery, there was ton of like bad stuff that happened as well as good stuff, but it's a complicated mess, and it doesn't really benefit us to pretend it wasn't. And that's why there's been so much pushback against those sort of just uncomplicated pro-American stories these days. And it sounds like he's just like totally tone deaf to that. There's two options. He's either totally tone deaf and he doesn't understand or know that this is going to rub a lot of people the wrong way, or he knows and he thinks that's not an important concern. And either way, I got to think like that's a weird way to position yourself, because he always seemed like
the man who didn't see any issue with the fact that a woman was replaced with a hotter nympho version of herself, and like the main character was just okay with that.
So I always got the impression from Peter Klein's work that he was kind of liberal, but kind of like a dumb dude. Not
that's
and
generous.
I don't mean well. I don't mean that is like that he was not intelligent. I just mean like he was a guy who didn't have like not that he didn't have not that he hated women or anything like that. He just was a guy who had ignorant opinions about women or who wanted to point out how hot certain women were, but not that he was into deep misogyny. But I didn't think I never got the impression that he was like super. I mean, this almost sounds like kind of right wing propaganda. like nationalist propaganda almost.
It does paint nationalism as a force of good created by gods.
Yeah. This kind of seems like nationalist propaganda, which I typically have associated with right-wing politics, which I don't think... I never got the impression that Peter Klein's was...
Me neither.
Like right-wing, so that does leave me thinking maybe he's... Maybe we've thought more about this story in the 45 minutes we've been talking about it.
I think we have. I think we've thought more about this story. As I was reading it, I felt like I put more thought into the story than he had.
See, this is why it's not good. I would advise people not to casually write this kind of fiction. You can write historical fiction if you know a lot about the topic and you know exactly what you want to say. But when you set it in a historical context, you kind of absorb all the baggage that that context has. And if you're not interested in exploring that baggage, why not just set it in an entirely fantastical place of your own imagination? But I guess he just wanted the free nostalgia, like memory berries or whatever, that come with the great American road trip. Wouldn't have done it.
Me neither.
Wouldn't have done it. What's this called? Paradox Bound?
Paradox Bound.
I just got to look real quick. I just got to know. Well, I'm getting the story secondhand from you, so I guess I haven't read it. I don't know how bad it is, but... like, the majority of people here seem to take issue with the fact that the time travel is stupid. Yeah, it actually seems to average 3-star reviews.
Oh, that's actually pretty bad.
That's pretty bad for Goodreads. Continue on.
So Harry continues to tell the story. Oh, God. She continues to tell the story that most of the answers of which are, quote, nobody knows. So somebody stole the dream from the Faceless Men sometime in the 1960s.
Is it an object?
It's some sort of object, yes.
Okay. Why did they call it the dream?
Because it's the American dream.
Did they know in 1776 people were going to say that?
Maybe the dream caused them to say that, Ben.
Oh, shit. That's a good point. Go on.
Got him. The Faceless Men were recruited from all over history, including a one-day war in 2029. They were forged by the Founding Fathers who wanted the dream to be guarded. The Faceless Men spent 100 years searching through 300 years of history for the dream, but never found it. And then they just kind of stopped for some reason, and probably not to look like a bunch of idiots, they decided that their main job from now on is going to be policing the timeline and shooting anyone who travels through time. And so that's what they decide to do. And apparently, they are bulletproof because of their certainty range. So there's a guy named Abraham Porter who killed 8 of them with a sniper rifle, even though you would think the bullet is going to travel into their certainty range and then they'd be certain of where the bullet was, but whatever. So what they do, because Peter Klein's probably knows this is a thing that exists, they maneuver their body in such a way that like the bullets would bounce off bone or something. But because I know very little about guns, but know that there are different calibers of bullet, you could just get a bigger caliber bullet, and you're not going to be bouncing off bones, you're going to be breaking it. That took like 2 seconds of Googling. But I guess the response to that would be, shut up, Nate.
Well, so they're human?
They're human that have been operated on. Operated how? Don't know.
So they still have, like, organs and stuff that they need?
Yes, apparently.
How do they eat?
Don't know. How do they talk? Don't know.
So, next question, I suppose. You might have glanced over this. When was the dream stolen?
1960s.
Oh, no.
I assume that was a JFK thing. But it could have also been a Nam thing.
Could have been a Civil Rights Act thing.
Oh, no! Oh, no!
Oh, no. So right about the time minorities started getting rights in America, the dream disappeared.
Oh, no.
Seriously, though, what in God's name was he thinking?
It gets better, Ben. Because the dream was stolen, our country is now unraveling. That's why there's so much civil unrest now. And that's why America is going down the shitter now, because
Nate,
the dream was
shut
stolen.
Shut up, Nate, shut up. This was published in 2017, and it is literally about time traveling to make America great again. Are you fucking kidding me?
Oh my God.
It's literally that.
It
was
is.
Stolen. It was stolen when? In the 1960s. When did minorities start getting rights? The 1960s. What do we want to take it back to? The 1960s. That's back when it was great. We need to make America great again.
Oh, no.
I think Peter Kleins is a secret MAGA guy.
You think so?
That or he's an idiot. Take your pick. I mean, this is propaganda. It's either on purpose or he's totally an idiot. But this is propaganda. At least the way you're describing it to me. I haven't read it, in all fairness. But the way you are describing this to me, it sounds like they're traveling through time to make America great again. It's that same nostalgia for a time that didn't really exist that MAGA taps into. It's, yeah, everything was just peachy keen before the 60s, right? Whether he stumbled onto it by accident or whether he did it intentionally, this is exactly the same misplaced sense of nostalgia for a time that didn't exist that MAGA taps into. I'm really sorry to say that because it's like you said, I don't know that he intended it.
I don't think he intended that. I'm looking at his Twitter timeline and he's highlighting anti-Trump stuff. I think he didn't put any thought into that.
So okay, let's get this on the record so you can cut around this. So we're relatively certain that Peter Kleins is not a Trump supporter. He's not a MAGA guy. But this story, I cannot help but think, draws its emotional core from a misplaced nostalgia for a time that never existed, which is exactly the theme of Make America Great Again. I find this to be very problematic in the original sense of the word, because I think he has stumbled ass backwards into creating like MAGA propaganda. And I could be, you know, people are going to accuse me of being dramatic. And it's like, oh, it's just a fun little story. That's the problem with these kinds of stories, though. This past doesn't exist, and if you're not going to deal with the baggage of America's past, then it is a bad idea to write about America's past, I think.
See, I was wondering, Ben, if I was being unfair, because when I got to the end of the book, I was like, okay, there are parts I like, and the parts I really hated, like, weren't part of the book. And I didn't know if I was being unfair to bring that into the discussion.
I liked the National Treasure movies. The National Treasure movies do embrace some of that. Well, I shouldn't say the movies. I liked the first one. I don't think I saw the others. But they definitely highlighted the good parts of America and didn't deal with the bad parts of America. But they didn't imply that things were better back when. They just implied that the American experiment was a great thing and continues to be a great thing, which I think is a defensible position to take. I'm not saying America bad. What I am saying is he is saying that America was going according to divine plan until the 60s, and then it went off track? What the fuck does that mean? What is off track to you? It's incredibly unthoughtful and harmful to an extent, and I'm incredibly disappointed with this take on American history. That's all I can say.
I put in my notes, it's reductivist bullshit, at the very least.
You know, I don't... I wanted to take it easy on him, but if you had told me the American dream was stolen shortly after the Revolutionary War and, you know, they did their best without guidance and mistakes were made, that'd be one thing. But to say everything, like, does she imply that everything was going well until that point?
I don't think that they say that, no. They just say that without the dream, we start to fracture.
But we only lost the dream in the 60s.
Right.
So we were united before then. And I know people are gonna accuse this argument of being like, why do you have to bring politics into everything? Why do you have to be such a negative Nancy about everything? It's like, because this is how those things get minimized in the first place, is we write stories like this without talking about them. He's literally mythologizing American history and just erasing the parts he doesn't like. That's a big problem. That's a big problem. I'm just going to say it. I stand by it. But yeah, let's move on. I've said all I can say.
Let's move on. Let's try to move on. So Eli, after learning all this information on how the world wasn't what he thought it was like, all right, now that I know, I guess I'll be going home now. And Harry's like, yeah, you aided and abetted a known criminal in front of the history police. You're a fugitive now, you idiot.
I was just thinking more about the fact that it's like, oh shit, I could travel through time. I could find the American dream and fix the world.
Time to go back to Sanders, Maine.
Yep. Lobster season's coming up. I wouldn't want to miss that.
I don't know what he expected. I don't know if he wanted to just hang out with his manic pixie dream girl, but I don't know. It's really weird that he expected, like, oh, I'm just going to go home now. So Harry's plan to find the dream is to find people who are influenced by the dream and then work backwards from there. So there's a gold prospector she needs to meet in Independence, Missouri in the 1800s. She bribes him to cooperate, basically. And he tells this story about how he met this guy and who struck it rich out in California. And he decided, like, I'm going to take a risk. I'm going to go to California. And then he, too, struck it rich out there. And so they get the name of this guy, some guy named Hawkins in New Orleans, and they get the approximate date. So they're going to go talk with that guy now. They're trying to work their way back to Revolutionary time.
So is nobody in the rest of the world rich?
Nobody in the rest of the world has the American dream, Ben.
But what does that mean?
It means nobody has summoned the Egyptian god Ptah to craft them a thing that does magic.
But is it a thing? Like, do we know that?
It is a thing.
And how do we know? So
because I read the book.
Her logic is that people
Ben, who have, Ben, I'll tell you what she would tell you if she were a real person. Quote, nobody knows for sure. End quote.
So how do you know these guys were touched by the dream?
Because it sounds like they were.
But why does it sound like that?
Because it sounds like they had the inspiration.
To what?
To go out and leave everything behind and to do a thing and take a chance, and it paid off for them.
Right. Nobody anywhere else in the world is doing that?
Apparently not. Or they're just not important. Because they're
like
dirty
England
foreigners.
Didn't do that in the first place to found America. Like, half of the European countries didn't come carve up the North American continent for exactly that reason.
Exactly, Ben. Nobody knows.
You can't not know what it is and also... fuck it, just go on.
So then 15 and 0 show up again. And they have to move through town.
Okay, wait. Time out again. I totally forgot. Why are these people being hunted by the things?
Because they're time travelers.
And you're not supposed to do that?
No.
Why?
Because they said so.
Why? What does it hurt?
One of the... Eli's boss, who I don't really want to mention much because he's pointless, he basically builds his fortune throughout time.
Okay. Boldly going where no one did before to carve out his future?
Yes.
Like the American dream?
Yes, but this is cheating somehow.
Okay. And... stealing native land and digging it up for gold.
That's all kosher, Ben. That's okay. The dream right there. Okay, manifest destiny. So the faceless men, they have to escape the faceless men. They can't go within 300 feet of them, or the faceless men will be certain of them, and then they'll be fucked.
How do the faceless men keep finding them? They just show up whenever the book needs a scene?
Yeah, somewhat, for the most part.
So basically what I'm hearing is if you're not within 300 feet of them, they don't know where you are, but they also know where you are.
They have some sort of advanced record keeping, Ben. There are thousands and thousands of faceless men, duplicates, all in their headquarters. Harry mails a letter that's going to arrive at one of her friends in the future to come bail them out.
And how did she get a time machine? Was that explained?
Her now dead husband came upon her in the 1800s, and they ran off together.
And that's a third time traveler?
Yeah, he's dead now, though.
How did he get a time machine?
It's never explained, but there's
a
chain.
Are you fucking kidding?
There's a chain, okay? Some guy probably gave it to him, and then the next guy up. How did the first one get it? Quote, nobody knows. End quote. Hey, it's Nate from the future here in my American steel jalopy, and holy shit, things are crazy here in the future. But I needed to come back to let you know that Peter Kleins actually does explain this. Basically, anyone with an American steel vehicle of any kind can go across the slick spots throughout time. Even you could be a time traveler. I also learned that the only way to prevent this bad future from happening is to follow our Twitter and... oh shit, Ben found me. I gotta get going.
This is just a fucking idea he had that he did not think through at all and just started writing.
And yet, Ben, it is my second favorite Peter Kleins book.
Why did you want to do this?
Because I just enjoy your reactions, Ben.
Why? I don't want to be mean to this guy, but...
but you can't help it.
It's just such... if you thought about it for 2 seconds, you'd realize, like, what am I actually saying here? And is that a thing I want to be saying? Go on.
Yeah, so the faceless men do end up finding them, and you would think, like, okay, absolute certainty, they will absolutely be certain where you are and how you'll move, so they can fire a bullet that's going to pierce your brain, absolutely, but they miss a whole bunch of times.
They're absolutely certain where you are, but they never actually practiced shooting. So they're still working on the aim. They thought escape. Being absolutely certain
Ben,
where you were was...
Ben. They escape because they are picked up by John Henry.
Oh, no. Why would you do this? Why are you doing this?
So John Henry, he travels around in a gigantic train that's large enough to hold cars and has its own, like, it's basically like a mobile hotel with a garage attachment.
Does John Henry know he's going to die trying to beat that machine?
Oh, that's explained that he actually beat the machine.
Okay. What the fuck is this?
So Eli asked him a whole bunch of questions, right?
Yeah, as one would.
And so Eli realizes that there are no future time travelers. So apparently, around the 2050, it's wildly divergent. Anyone who comes back from that time, they all have different records. Like, you know, one of them said it was a utopia. One of them said, like, warring states. Another was a nuclear holocaust. And another one said that, like, there was a giant monster flying around eating up the world. Because of course.
Oh, God.
Of course. He had to do it.
Oh, God damn it.
Also, John Henry's like, I feel like, you know, what if history is unraveling? And I'm like, but it can't be unraveling because the dream has already been relocated because that's how the time travel... It's stupid.
That's John Henry how he feels about the state of the country before 1960. Was it better or worse?
They also importantly think that Eli is from a slick spot, that Sanders was stuck in the 1980s, and Eli thinks that's not true because nobody there wants it to be that rural and shitty. All right, so they go to New Orleans. They meet Hawkins. It sounds like he drove through Maine at one point, and he was inspired by something, but he's kind of blowing them off, and then they go through a very long detour, and they go on a really long detour. And they end up in a town called Hourglass that was made by that guy, Abraham Porter, who shot a bunch of those faceless men. Now, there are three bars in Hourglass. There's the first time around, the second iteration, and the final paradox. And that's also the name of the three parts of this book. And you're allowed to go to Hourglass three times for 1 week each. The first time you go to the first time around bar, and then the second, you get the idea. And once the dream is found, you're allowed to go to the final paradox. And the faceless men don't come here because there are so many different copies of the same people that killing any of them would fuck up time.
What?
Yes. Also, Eli is wearing a bowler hat and has been the entire time, and he never takes it off after this, including when he's back in the present.
Why are there copies of people? This is news to me. Was that a thing in the book before?
They're so, okay. I go back in time 10 minutes to my own house. I'm there in my house twice.
Right.
That's the same thing here.
That's a paradox. Okay.
Yeah. So there are different copies of the same people because they all go to the same 1 week in time in the same town, but they go to different areas in the town.
Okay. Potentially neat idea.
So Harry and Eli, they go to the second iteration, and Harry explains her past self is over in the first time around celebrating her honeymoon.
Okay.
So they meet a bunch of side characters who are unimportant, and Harry looks around and realizes there are no unfamiliar faces in this bar. So there are no new generations of time travelers. It ends with them. So someone has to find the dream, or they're all dead. One of the two. And then Harry remembers that her husband, on the night of their honeymoon, was talking to a guy dressed exactly like Eli, so, like, off you go. And so he goes over there, and he talks to her husband, and her husband realizes that from Eli's perspective, he's already dead. And he takes that news in stride. And then Eli exits the bar, and some shit happens with his boss that is completely irrelevant, but his kneecap gets busted.
Okay.
And so Harry takes him to a clinic in the future. Or, okay, here's something that's going to bother me, and it Peter Coins doesn't know the difference between a clinic and a hospital. He constantly okay. confuses the two in this chapter. He's like,
what if Nate, like, in the future, like, a clinic is what we now consider to be a hospital, and a hospital is like some kind of just tower of medicine.
So this is, I think, in like the 2030s. So there must be a radical shift. Oh yeah, we're on track for that. There must be a radical shift in healthcare. So again, he doesn't know the difference between a clinic or a hospital. He doesn't know what an annual physical is. He doesn't know how scars work. Peter, if you're listening to this and you haven't seen a doctor once a year, you need to go get your checkup. This is something everyone has to do.
If you're listening to this, I am willing to edit these books for a fee. I can catch all this shit ahead of time, or we can straighten it out together. You'll easily sell 5 more copies.
Oh, we also learned that Abraham Porter became 15, the faceless man. That's important, I guess.
Yep. Oh, boy, that was a character I'd grown real attached to.
So, Eli starts thinking in his drug stupor that the dream was in Sanders' mane all along. Let's look at the facts, Ben. Time slows down around the dream, just like Sanders.
I didn't know that was a fact either.
And that guy Hawkins that they talked to in New Orleans also went through Maine.
Oh, yeah, I remember Hawkins.
So, checkmate.
Well,
and so they go to Sanders.
Two people were in Maine.
So they go to Sanders, Maine, and they realize that the dream must be in the Founder's house. What is the Founder's house? It's briefly mentioned in the first chapter as a, like, abandoned house that's so boring it doesn't even have ghost stories about it.
For some reason, I thought you were going to say burlesque bar.
That'd be better. So they're going there, and then they're like, actually, I think I'm wrong. Like, this isn't where the dream is. It's where it used to be. This is the headquarters of the Faceless Men. And so they have to go through a massive car chase with carloads of faceless men coming after them. So this is where they meet Eli as an 8-year-old from the first chapter.
It seems like the Faceless Men don't really have a role in the story.
They're there to chase them a lot.
I guess they provide the ticking clock, but like, what if the Faceless Men just weren't there?
Well, then there wouldn't be enough action.
But it would be the same story.
There wouldn't be action, Ben! You need explosions!
But
car
nothing...
chases!
Right. But nothing changes.
Ben.
The Faceless Men never prevent them from doing a thing they want to
do. The Faceless Men don't do shit. Eventually, they lose them through time, except for Zero. And Eli realizes that there was once this old, junked-up car that he threw rocks at as a kid. And he puts two and two together with, like, that's this guy's car. So I'm going to go to this location, and boom, Zero crashes. And then Eli gets poetic justice because Zeke once threw a rock at him, so he threw a rock at Zeke. And they pistol whip him a lot, too, by the way.
So, okay, the bully did what to this guy when he was a kid?
He threw a rock at his head.
I mean, is that all he ever did to him?
He also did a bunch of other shit that he was just generally... He was a stereotypical 80s bully then.
So then he was... kidnapped, mutilated, and now he's being tortured for yucks. But it's okay because he was a bully when he was a child.
Yeah.
Did I mention I am so fucking over the 80s?
So the Faceless Men have these badges that's basically like Doctor Who psychic paper, but a little different. Like,
oh, a Doctor Who inspired fantasy? Okay.
Exactly, right? Who would have thought? So they're like, fuck it, let's just go steal the American Dream ourselves, at least then we'll know where the fuck it is. And then we can return it, and everything will be right. So they go to the founder's house, and he holds up the badge, and no one really pays any attention to him until they do. And then a whole bunch, like thousands of faceless men are chasing them, and they go to the dream chamber, and there's no dream there. Even though it's in the it's like in the 1700s now, or the 1800s.
Yeah, I'm going to point out, how in God's name would they know? Because they have no idea what it is.
Oh, yeah, there's also an American flag, several of them, and one of them has 55 stars, or 54 stars, one of those two.
That's a neat detail, but...
It totally changes all the bad things he already said.
It's just, how do they know any one of these objects are not the dream? Like, what is the dream?
It's supposed to be on this pedestal, Ben.
How do they know that?
Because... It just seems like it should be.
What if it is the pedestal? What if it's the chamber?
Well, Ben, it's not the chamber because the faceless men say that it's not the chamber.
Okay.
So the faceless men have them cornered. And there's some stupid favor system that I didn't really go into. It's not important. But basically, the faceless man, who was once Abraham Porter, gives them a great American tradition, Ben. The filibuster. So they have to stand on the podium and they can't leave it for any reason. And if they stop talking for more than a minute, they will be executed. And they have to convince the faceless men not to kill them with a sound, logical argument.
So they can't just read children's books like our politicians do.
So Eli figures out, by talking to him, the reason that they haven't been killed with plot armor is because Eli is, quote, uncertain, end quote, because he grew up around the dream in close proximity. So that's why the faceless men keep missing them with their guns. And also that's why they kidnapped Zeke, because they want to nullify their advantage.
But why do they keep missing her?
Because he's near her, and that carries over.
Okay. And Zeke is... How does Zeke being equally uncertain cancel that out?
I can't tell you that.
I think that would just make them both even very more uncertain. What the fuck does that even mean? Okay, go on.
No idea. So then Eli's like, wait a minute. I think I know where the dream was. Guys, you're time
Eli,
travelers.
Eli, shut up. You've been wrong every time.
You time travelers, you've been traveling all over time, right? And you've all been wishing to find the American dream. And all those wishes focus the dream to steal itself. And so Eli reaches to where the dream should be, and there it is.
The dream was the friends we made along the way.
So then his one wish is...
Wait, is it Dragon Balls now?
Yes. He could actually do more with it, but he decides, like, I'm going to be altruistic, just like the Founding Fathers. I'm going to wish that you guys just let us leave in peace, and you can go back to guarding the dream again.
Why don't you just wish they had their faces back and end the whole madness?
Because they consider it a duty, Ben. Probably because they were beaten and conditioned to do that, but don't think about that, Ben. Because later on, as they're leaving the secret headquarters of the Faceless Men, they realize that Zeke is there among them, a future iteration of him. And in fact, the same Faceless Man who operated on Zeke was Zeke himself from the future. Ergo, Ben! Ergo!
Okay, I'm starting to see now why the Goodreads reviews focused in on the time travel.
Now that they're moving the dream and the Faceless Man headquarters, Eli has to remain in Sanders for a couple months at least, while time starts flowing normally in Sanders for some reason.
Why'd they move the dream? Where'd the dream go?
They moved the dream somewhere secret so that no one knows where it is now.
The Faceless Men did?
Yes. Eli, he gets a bunch... his friends, they sell their video store and move out. His mom apparently can lease some of their land for a new cell phone tower. And one of his boss's bodyguards who lives pretends like his boss is still alive, and she writes him a gigantic check so that he'll keep his mouth shut, basically. Oh, and, and Eli continues to wear his stupid fucking bowler hat everywhere because it's totally making a comeback, quote.
So how do the time travelers feel about this? They sought this thing their entire lives. Many of them died for it. And they're just cool with this?
Yeah, they're cool with it. It was all the thrill of the chase, I guess. Plus,
was the friends we made along the way.
Yes. Plus, they didn't. The faceless men said they're not going to kill any more of them unless they unless they're doing what Eli's boss did and use time travel abusively. So then Eli decides he's going to go meet up with Harry at the Hourglass at that final bar, and then Harry's like, "Huh, you know, after this, why don't we go explore Canadian or Cuban history?" And I, what? Like, I'm unclear how the dream works then. If it's the American dream, how can you go through Cuban or Canadian history? Whatever. Whatever. So, that's the end of the book, Ben. I think he wanted to have a fun, lighthearted adventure and just...
You're telling me...
Boy, did he miss that point.
You're telling me the founders had... Dragon Balls, a magical wishing stone of some sort, and they still employed human slaves.
Yes, and they didn't free any of them or stop the Civil War or any of that.
Create a utopia.
Yes, they didn't create a paradise on Earth. Two stars.
So he's improving, I guess.
He's improving, yes.
In that he at least noticed some of his bullshit and thought he needed to come up with an explanation for it. I gotta go back and say that the flawed from the ground up. I mean...
I will disagree with that in one regard. I think... Doctor Who meets National Treasure, that being just your jot that you write down on your napkin, that's fine. The concept is okay. It's all the execution is just, huh.
Well, I guess I would even go a little further and say the idea of the American dream being a real thing is kind of okay. The idea that it disappeared in the 1960s is the first thing, literally the first thing that occurred to me when you said it disappeared in the 1960s was, they had it that long?
Yeah, the Civil War was 100 years prior.
Yeah.
Where the Union fractured and started killing itself.
You obviously don't want to talk about that for whatever reason. How can you not talk about that? How can you think that you need to establish why they kept missing their shots, but you don't need to establish why they didn't use the stone to fix the problems? Because you didn't notice any problems is the only thing I can think of. And the fact that you didn't notice any problems tells me that you either don't know much about American history, like not even at a sixth grade level, or you didn't think of those things as problems. It's too big a... That's where the book dies for me. It's too big a flaw for me to... Like, that'd take me right out of the book, because I cannot imagine any rational person... Any rational person looking at the country in 1950 and thinking we had some magical wishing device. McCarthyism.
Oh, yeah. It's problematic, to say the least.
Yeah. And it's not like there wasn't even... Like, there was still poverty. There were still hungry people, like...
But, Ben, there were also people who went to California to get a bunch of gold. So
yeah,
like
those three guys who got rich in California, definitely, obviously, that was some countrywide magic. I have to quit. It takes me out of the book because none of the characters are asking the rational question of what does the dream do? When? Oh, they lost it then? But if it's a wishing stone, why didn't it? Why didn't anyone wish for things to be better? Like, you're telling me you can't think of a single improvement? What about all the people just wishing their lives didn't suck?
Well, if they're any time after the 1960s, that would fall on deaf ears, Ben.
Because I'm pretty sure there were people
in the 1960s. No, before 1960, there was no one who wished, like, the Great Depression? That didn't...
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you could just think of endless examples. There would not be politics of any kind if everything just was going great. Do you think he was trying to say anything with this book, or do you think it was just stream of thought? I had an idea. What if the American Dream were real? Doctor Who meets National Treasure. I'm just going to start typing.
Probably the latter. I don't think for one second that Peter Collins is like an avid historian.
So I don't know. It was probably more fun to read than The Fold, I would guess, by the fact that you're ranking it higher.
It's more fun to read than The Fold, yes.
Okay.
Which is a very low bar. Let's be honest here.
Now, though, The Fold is less offensive to me. The Fold worked because the problems are contained within their chapter. When you correlate them with other chapters, they become obvious. This, though, the problem is immediately obvious right as soon as you encounter it. And so I have to wonder even more, did anybody... It's just got to be a collection of people who just did not want to go there. Like, they just didn't want to be the person to make it political. That's the only thing I can think of, is that the group of people who tackled this book just don't... They read it, they're like, oh, that's fun. And either they don't think about history the way I think about it at all, and so it never occurred to them to ask that question. But 2017, I mean, I feel like everybody's been extra political the last 4 years. How do you not see the Make America Great Again message in this book?
I think I found The Fold worse, maybe because it's that whole it's a personal thing versus like the group thing, where you're like, you're sexualizing a person and like you're removing their identity as a person for a sex object trophy.
The Fold was also, the characters sucked.
And like I said, the two leads don't hook up. So I gave him brownie points for that. All right, we should wrap up. Next week, we're going to do our season one wrap up. It'll be 2021 next week. So I'm pretty sure that means all the COVID goes away and we're ushering in a new age of enlightenment, right? That's how that works. After that, uplifting message, next month, we're reading Edenverse. You can get it for free on our website, that's poorlywritten.ninja, or you can buy it for 99 cents. Makes a great, I guess this comes out after Christmas, makes a great New Year's gift.
As always, please don't forget to check us out on Twitter at WABpod. We're pretty active over there. You can also check us out on Goodreads. We have a group over there, Words About Books Podcast. If you find that group, you can also find me and Nate. If you want to give us a follow, we'll follow you back. Don't forget to check out our write-in, as Nate mentioned, at poorlywritten.ninja. We also have a blog that accompanies this podcast where we write additional show notes and commentary, as well as a few interesting things that just happen to be on our mind. You could find that at blog.wordsaboutbooks.ninja. And if you're just not getting enough podcast content from us, please check out our friends over at Words About Games. They do a video game podcast for the modern adult. And with that, I have finished all of my shameless plugging and my exhaustion. I don't know why you thought I'd want to hear this after my Trump episodes, but yeah, I think I'm just going to turn my mic off and stare quietly at a wall.
Sounds good. Bye.
Later. People's Reviews is the one person sums it up so perfectly. I'm slowly coming to the conclusion that I want to like Peter Klein's books more than I actually do like them.
Well, we didn't... We're going to have to go over this next week's episode, but we definitely could have cut a lot of that. It was like, I think...
They're feature-length films.
Three hours of fold content?
No. It's 4.5.
Oh, my God.
Almost 5. Well, we don't want the entire Republican caucus to become erect, okay?